Fine.
Venti water.
Hi.
I know. Good to see you. Really glad to see you. Let's do it after. It'd be great. Should be wiring up that right about now.
Thank you.
Am I properly wired on my schedule?
Are you still like kind of stepping around there? Doing like.
When do you before you do this? Which is part of the civilization. It's just an initiative state of Christmas thing. Presidential thing, I'm not confirming. Confirmed by the staff. Yeah, I got it. You may what? When you think you know, you have to turn on this little switch here.
Yeah.
And I'm told that it's best to have the microphone close up in the Okay. Wouldn't that be super high? That's approximately here. So like that. Are you from Wisconsin? Yeah, in Bali, yeah, the separation. I'm fine.
because a whole year to compensate the amount of the loss for 2 days.
Good evening to you all. Welcome to all of you here in the face-to-face audience in Ames Courtroom, and welcome to our online audience in cyberspace. My name is Charles Nesson. I'm the Wells Professor of Law and the Director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society here at Harvard Law School. This event tonight is an exercise, an effort of the Berkman Center to further the process of integrating exciting face-to-face events that take place here at the law school with an online audience in ways that we hope will be engaging to both. Our online audience coming in at the moment into a series of environments, discussion environments that have been created for the purpose, will be moderated this evening by Professor Jack Balkin. Jack Balkin is sitting in the back of the room. Jack, can you give a wave? A wave. Jack is back there at a table with a keyboard in front of him. He's lightning fast at the keyboard. He's assisted by a crew of teaching assistants. How about all of you waving as well? All back there, relating to our online audience. Jack Balkin is the Knight Professor of Constitutional Law and the First Amendment at Yale Law School. He's also the Director of the Information Society Project at Yale Law School, and is and has been a visiting professor here at Harvard during this year. We're delighted to have Jack, and this is an innovative activity. You're a brave man, Jack. Good luck tonight. Would you all give Jack a hand for his... the moderator for our face-to-face event here, to whom I'll almost immediately turn over the program, is Miss Diane Rosenfeld. Diane is a fellow of the Berkman Center. She has led the Berkman Center's online lecture and discussion series, which is an online teaching event that has gone on earlier this spring, on the subject of violence against women. Before joining us, she served as the senior counsel to the Violence Against Women Office at the United States Department of Justice. Would you join me in welcoming Diane? And I now turn the program over to her.
Thank you very much, Professor Nesson. Welcome to this discussion of the constitutionality of the federal civil right to be free from gender-motivated violence. I want to extend a special welcome to Professor Catherine McKinnon, the Elizabeth Long Professor of Law at University of Michigan Law School, and also a Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School. And a special welcome to Professor Charles Fried, who is the beneficial Professor of Law at Harvard and was Solicitor General under Ronald Reagan during the second term from 1985 to 1989, and was an Associate Justice on the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts from 1995 to 1999. And thank you for coming and agreeing to share your views with us tonight on this very important subject. This event is being sponsored by the Berkman Center, and I wanted to thank Professor Nesson for helping put it together, and Professor Zittrain and John Wilbanks and Ben Edelman for all their technological wizardry. And a special thanks to Professor Balkin for agreeing to be our online moderator and riding the cutting edge of technology into the new millennium. And a very special thanks to Rebecca Nesson, who is a second year law student here, and it was actually, this event is her brainchild, so a special thanks to Rebecca for unbelievably hard work and great organizational skills and substantive work on putting this all together. Congratulations, Rebecca. good turn. And finally, thanks to the co-sponsors of the event for their help and support, the Ann Radcliffe Trust the Harvard Women's Studies Department, the Women in Public Policy Program of the Kennedy School at Harvard, the Harvard Women's Law Association, the Harvard Federalist Society, and Jane Doe, Inc., the Massachusetts Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I'm honored to be in the role of moderator here tonight for this very, very important discussion. I thought carefully about my role as moderator because, as Professor Nesson said, I was the senior counsel in the Violence Against Women office at the Department of Justice and have been involved in defending the constitutionality of the statute. But tonight's event is a discussion about the critical issues raised by the Supreme Court case on what the government's role is in addressing violence against women. I think it's fair to say that both Professor Fried and Professor McKinnon are social activist lawyers, but that each pursues a different vision of what a just society looks like. Tonight we have the unique opportunity to get a more textured insight into their respective views, and we can more freely explore the ideas and theories of law than we could if we were arguing before the Supreme Court. And the purpose of this evening's event is to have an open discussion about the hard questions that each side faces in this case. We all agree that violence against women is a grave social problem. Professor Fried explicitly recognized this when, as a Massachusetts Supreme Court justice, he authored the opinion in Custody of Vaughn, in which the court required that trial judges make a detailed and comprehensive finding of fact in issues of domestic violence and its effect on children and their custody decisions. I want to quote from the case. He said, quote, quite simply, abuse by a family member inflicted on those who are weaker and less able to defend themselves, almost invariably a child or a woman, is a violation of the most basic human right, the most basic condition of civilized society, the right to live in physical security, free from the fear that brute force will determine the conditions of one's daily life. For those who are its victims, force within a family and in intimate relationships is not less but more of a threat to this basic condition of a civilized security, for it destroys the security that all should enjoy in the very place and context which is supposed to be the refuge against the harshness encountered in the world of strangers. Unquote. This case is regarded as very important in the domestic violence advocacy community, and there's now legislation in Massachusetts that gives a presumption against granting custody to a parent convicted of domestic violence. As this quote demonstrates, Professor Fried clearly understands the violation of human rights that violence against women represents. However, he is opposed to the federal civil right to be free from gender-motivated violence under the VAWA, the Violence Against Women Act, for reasons that he will make clear to us. Professor Fried second chaired the argument in the Supreme Court when the U.S. versus Morrison case was heard in January. Professor McKinnon is widely regarded as the foremother of feminist legal theory. She published her first book in 1979, The Sexual Harassment of Working Women, in which she set forth a new legal theory that a previously unnamed injury suffered overwhelmingly by women affected their rights to compete equally in the workplace. This theory has transformed the landscape of the workplace and women's opportunities within it. Her contribution to the field of violence against women is that she has reconceived crimes against women as violations of sex equality. Her theory is that sexual assault violates our civil rights, most particularly our equality rights. This enables us to reconfigure things we thought of as crimes that nothing is being done about as instead violations of our equal status as citizens. She has given us a new theory of equal protection under the law. Indeed, the Violence Against Women Act civil rights remedy is an enactment of this theory. My comments from this point on will lay a foundation for this evening's discussion. First, I will describe the Violence Against Women Act and the relevant legal background to this case. Second, I will give a brief factual and procedural history of the Brancala case, now known as U.S. versus Morrison. So Congress passed the Violence Against Women Act in 1994 after 4 years of legislative hearings on the problem and the pervasive amount of violence against women in this country. The VAWA contains three main provisions, although it has other provisions that I'm not going to discuss tonight. But the three main provisions are, first, it contains several criminal provisions which criminalize interstate acts of domestic violence, such as crossing a state line in violation of an order of protection or to commit abuse against an intimate partner. The second main provision authorizes $1.6 billion of grant funding to states to help them develop innovative and progressive programs within the state to develop and to address domestic violence. And the third main part of the Violence Against Women Act is the civil rights remedy. This provision gives all persons the right to be free from gender-motivated violence. Under this provision, one can bring a claim against a person who committed an act of violence against her or him that was at least in part motivated by a gender-based animus. It's a private civil lawsuit independent of the underlying criminal prosecution, and it's this provision at issue in the case that we're discussing tonight. A little background on the civil rights provision. It was the most controversial provision of the VAWA. 41 states lobbied Congress in favor of the VAWA and this provision. Gender bias studies from 21 states were introduced into the congressional record. For example, my former boss, the Illinois Attorney General Roland Burris, stated in the record that, quote, until women as a class have the same protection afforded others who are the object of irrational, hate-motivated abuse and assault, we as a society should feel humiliated and ashamed, unquote. States cited systematic failures of the criminal justice system to adequately address crimes of violence against women and invited this federal legislation to strengthen the possible response. On the other hand, the Chief Justice Rehnquist spoke out against the civil rights provision, fearing that it could overwhelm the federal courts. The Conference of Chief Justices, while supporting the intended objectives of the civil rights provision, adopted a resolution against the 1991 version of the Act, fearing that it could, quote, cause major state federal jurisdictional problems and disruption in the processing of domestic relations cases in state courts, unquote. However, in 1993, this Conference of Chief Justices adopted a resolution taking no position, so in effect withdrawing their objections, the version that was passed was substantially more narrow than the original version. The civil rights provision was passed as Title III of the Violence Against Women Act, which is part of the Omnibus Crime Control Bill of 1994. It was passed pursuant to Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce under the Commerce Clause and under the Enforcement Clause of the 14th Amendment, which guarantees due process and equal protection to all citizens. Since the VAWA was passed, two major Supreme Court cases struck down federal legislation in each of these areas, thus potentially calling into question the legal framework for permissible congressional action. The first was the Lopez case, which was decided in 1995. In Lopez, the U.S. Supreme Court reversed a long trend of liberal interpretation of congressional authority to pass legislation under the Commerce Clause. The Constitution gives Congress the authority to regulate matters that move in interstate commerce or affect interstate commerce. In Lopez, the court struck down the Gun-Free School Zones Act, holding that the law forbidding possession of a gun within 1,000 feet of a school had an insufficient nexus to interstate commerce. Schools were deemed a matter of fundamentally local control, and the act was found to intrude upon an area of regulation, schools, traditionally reserved to the states. In the second case, the city of Burney versus Flores, which we refer to as Burney, the Supreme Court struck down the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was called RFRA, in case anybody uses these acronyms, hopefully you'll remember what they were. The RFRA was struck down as an unconstitutional exercise of Congress's power to legislate under the 14th Amendment Enforcement Clause. And RFRA involved a statute that was passed directly to overturn a Supreme Court case that was decided in 1990 and sought to reinstate legislatively an earlier test to determine whether a law substantially burdened a religious practice. The Supreme Court struck down the attempt to overturn its ruling, and the holding that is relevant to the VAWA case is the finding that laws must be remedial in nature and that this remedy must be congruent and proportional to the problem it seeks to correct. Now I'll give you a brief background of the Brancala case, which is now U.S. versus Morrison, after I get some more water. I'll give you a brief description of the facts and the procedural history, which is an interesting one. So here then are the facts as recited by the Fourth Circuit in its decision. When considering an appeal of an order granting a motion to dismiss, a court must accept as true the facts alleged in the complaint. So with that in mind, Christy Brancala entered Virginia Polytechnic Institute, Virginia Tech, as a freshman in the fall of 1994. On the evening of September 21, 1994, Brancala and another female student met two men who Brancala knew only by their first names and as their status as members of the Virginia Tech football team. Within 30 minutes of first meeting Brancalo, these two men, later identified as Antonio Morrison and James Crawford, raped her, repeatedly changing places and without using a condom. Following the assault, Brancalo became depressed and avoided contact with most residents of her dorm outside of her room. She radically changed her appearance by cutting off her long hair. She ceased attending classes and eventually attempted suicide. She later sought and received a retroactive withdrawal from Virginia Tech for the 1994-1995 academic year. She brought a complaint under the university's sexual assault policy. The university held hearings when defendant Crawford was dismissed. Morrison was found guilty and suspended from school for two semesters. But then he appealed. The school held another hearing for which Brancalo was given only limited notice and limited access to the records from the first hearing. At the second hearing, without Brancalo's knowledge, the school reduced the sexual assault charge against Morrison to one of abuse of language. But then he was found guilty again and the sentence was reimposed. But then he appealed yet again, and this time his sentence was suspended until after he graduated. So in effect, he was suspended from school after he graduated from school. Brancalo was not notified of this and learned about it instead from a Washington Post article in the fall after she returned to school. Morrison had returned to school as well on full athletic scholarship. Brancalo withdrew from school and brought this action under the Violence Against Women Act, and this was the first major case brought under this provision. The district court dismissed Brancalo's claim. Although it found that she had stated a claim for gender-motivated violence, the court held that the civil rights remedy was beyond Congress's power to pass under Lopez and its interpretation of the Commerce Clause. The judge found evidence of gender-based animus in defendant Morrison's alleged public statement that he made in the cafeteria that he, quote, liked to get women drunk and fuck the shit out of them, unquote. Judge Kaiser also explained the different types of rape, and in distinguishing date rape from stranger rape, he stated, quote, date rape could also involve a situation where a man's sexual passion provokes the rape by decreasing the man's control, unquote. Judge Kaiser also held the vow of civil rights remedy unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment. The case was appealed to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, where a 2-to-1 panel held in favor of upholding Brancalo's claim. The dissenting judge, Ludig, said that his brethren would overturn the case when they heard it en banc. He said this in his dissent, which means when they reheard it with the full court. And indeed, there was then an en banc rehearing, and a year later, the full Fourth Circuit reversed the panel and affirmed the district court's dismissal of the claim. The Fourth Circuit found that the vow of civil rights remedy could not be sustained under the Lopez case, as violence against women does not substantially affect interstate commerce in a way that can justify federal legislation. Although Congress had held 4 years of extensive legislative hearings on the impact of violence against women on the national economy, the court found these effects to be too tenuous. It found unconvincing the congressional finding that violence against women, quote, substantially affects, unquote, interstate commerce, and regarded the finding more as a legal conclusion. Driving the decision was a concern for federalism, that the law threatened to overtake an area of state sovereignty and blurred the lines between federal and state authority and political responsibility. The Fourth Circuit also found the VAWA unconstitutional under the Enforcement Clause of the 14th Amendment, which gives Congress the authority to pass legislation enforcing the protections of the 14th Amendment, including the guarantee of equal protection, which is the provision relevant to this case. The Fourth Circuit determined that Congress could not remedy state violations of equal protection by regulating the conduct of private persons. In the arguments before the Supreme Court that took place in January, most of the questions from the justices revolved around Lopez and the Commerce Clause. From this emerges a hard question for both sides that we'll probably discuss tonight, which is that if Congress cannot pass legislation treating violence against women as a civil rights violation after it has been shown to substantially affect interstate commerce and cause violations of equal protection under the laws, what can it legislate? On the other hand, if congressional authority can reach private, non-commercial acts of violence against women, where are the limits on this power? Can it then reach any problem related to violence, as violence can be shown to affect interstate commerce? Also, not much was discussed about the important equal protection aspects of the VAWA case, so I hope we have the chance to address these here tonight as well. Now I will turn it over to Professor Fried, who will speak for 15 to 20 minutes, after which Professor McKinnon will speak. Then we will open up to questions from the live audience with Professor Balkin back there. Still back there? and from you, the live audience. So stay live and press it free.
Thank you, Diane. The genesis of this program, I think, was in our constitutional law class, in which Rebecca Nesson is a student, where we discussed this case. And the class was, I think, a very interesting and successful one, because what we did is we considered the problems that each side going into the argument faced in presenting its case. And that is how I propose to spend most of my time. But I did think I ought to begin by explaining why I got into this litigation at all. Diane was good enough to quote from some words which I'm very proud to have written and which I'm glad have been noticed and are repeated, because I think violence against women and children and dependent people and people who are in a situation of vulnerability is a very horrible thing and must be dealt with severely. I got into this case pro bono because I thought something very important was at stake, and I hoped to make some contribution in having that important issue resolved in a way that seemed to me to be correct. What was at stake in the case for me was the proposition that the Constitution means something, that its text and its doctrines and its precedents cannot be simply stretched and pulled and pushed to mean anything at all when there is an urgent enough or a popular enough reason to twist or bend the Constitution out of shape. I think that's very important, because I think our liberties are at stake if that proposition is not respected. Today is VAWA, tomorrow it could be flag burning, and the day after that it could be something else which I cannot even imagine. Now, the limits which I thought the VAWA transgressed and the doctrines which I thought it violated were two. First, there's the proposition in the Constitution that our Congress is not a legislature which has the general powers of government. The Congress has only enumerated powers, only those specific, detailed powers which the Constitution assigns to it. And it seemed wrong to me to stretch those definitions of the enumerated powers so that, in fact, they could, at will and in a sufficiently attractive and politically urgent case, be made, in fact, to grant Congress a general power of government. To use the words of the Constitution, the Congress has the power to tax and spend for the general welfare. It only has the power to regulate interstate commerce. Now, VAWA, in one of its provisions, and I think the most useful and important of its provisions, does exactly what the Constitution allows Congress to do. It spends for the general welfare, that is to say, it spends a fairly substantial amount of money in assisting battered women's shelters and in educational programs for state prosecutors and judges and law enforcement officials on the problem of violence against women. That is an example of spending for the general welfare, and the Constitution specifically assigns that authority to Congress. However, as far as regulation goes, that is something which Congress may do when it is regulating, among other things which are not relevant here, regulating commerce among the several states. And what brought me into this case is I thought that to say that creating a cause of action was a regulation of commerce among the several states, was the kind of exaggerated, sophisticated reasoning under which anything could mean anything and our liberties would go down the tube. The second principle is the principle embedded in the 14th Amendment, which is a guarantee of certain substantive liberties and also of equal protection. But the 14th Amendment guarantees those substantive rights and liberties and guarantees equal protection only against the states. That is to say, the 14th Amendment says, no state shall, etc. And the important principle there is that, therefore, those who are not state actors are not those against whose action the 14th Amendment protects, and therefore the Constitution does not grant Congress any power to create causes of action or otherwise to regulate the conduct of non-state actors, which may have substantial and serious effects on other non-state actors. And it seemed to me important that these principles be maintained and not be undermined by gimmicks and partisan findings. Now, going into this case, our side had a very considerable tailwind. First of all, two courts below had held that the Violence Against Women Act provisions before us here were unconstitutional, that the two purported bases, the Commerce Clause and the 14th Amendment, would not support the cause of action Congress had enacted. And the other tailwind, and a particularly important one, was that in the two cases, Lopez and then Bernie, which Diane talked to us about, and then the Bernie case reaffirmed just the year before in the Florida prepaid case, the court had in harshly contested decisions come to conclusions which had been contested for many decades and had finally reached very narrow majorities, 5-4 in both cases, but very definite conclusions. First, that the Commerce Clause must be limited in some way. It cannot be turned into a general power of government. And specifically, the court said that Congress, in regulating commerce, must either be regulating a channel of commerce, an instrumentality of commerce, or that which has a substantial effect on commerce. And in Lopez, the court held that the Gun-Free School Zone Act could not be shown to have a substantial effect on commerce, even though Justice Breyer, in dissent, had written an extensive opinion explaining how guns in and near school seriously degraded the quality of education in those schools, how these seriously degraded educational opportunities degraded the situation of the communities in which such schools were located, impacted on the educational opportunities of the students in those schools, and thereby affected the economy of the communities in which those schools existed. Nonetheless, faced with this very extensive and heavily documented dissenting opinion, the court said no, the connection was too remote and too attenuated. And in the Bernie case, similarly, the court had finally come to rest on a proposition that had been in dispute for decades, about the necessity of limiting Congress's power under the 14th Amendment to enforce the equal protection, but to enforce only what the Constitution itself stated was a violation of equal protection, and that is a violation by state actors. Now, going into the argument, it seems to me that both sides had rather similar problems. That is to say, we both had the problem of avoiding the argument that proves too much. The United States and the plaintiff, Christy Brancala, were obviously going to rely heavily on the congressional findings. But of course, relying on the congressional findings is indeed an example of an argument that might be seen to prove too much, because it's pretty plain, in fact, it's so plain that that Professor Tribe in the most recent edition, textbook points out that congressional findings cannot make the difference, because those findings can pretty generally always be produced. So that's the problem on that side. The problem on our side, I thought, was how to avoid an argument which would in fact disenable Congress from dealing with vital national problems which the court was not going to want to put out of the reach of the Congress by some general proposition, the implications of which it could not foresee. So there were three choices. One choice was to argue that this indeed was something which, as a matter of degree, surpassed Lopez, was more remote both qualitatively and quantitatively than Lopez. The second alternative was to argue a categorical approach. That is to say, to claim that a substantial effect on commerce could allow congressional regulation, but only if the activity regulated was itself an economic activity, which violence against women, except in connection, I suppose, with prostitution and pimps enforcing their authority over their stable, is not an economic activity. And third, the third possibility would be to argue something that Diane mentioned, which is that this intruded on a traditional state concern, in the sense that laws against battery, against mayhem, against against assault and rape are the stuff and substance of state law. Our judgment was that to make the first category, the first quantitative, qualitative discussion, that this was too remote, was a very dangerous kind of a discussion. There were four very, very clever justices there who would be delighted to see Lopez undermined, and who would have been very able to take up the whole of the argument time in showing why this maybe was less remote than Lopez rather than more remote. And that seemed like a fight that one could not on oral argument very successfully win. The second was the one we chose, the notion of a categorical limit, that the conduct regulated must be economic conduct. This was the line taken by the Fourth Circuit, and it had some substantial support in the opinion of the Supreme Court in Lopez itself, although it would press too hard to say that it was a definitive holding of Lopez. The third problem, in the third category, the traditional state concern, was a real problem, and we did not emphasize it, because it has been the case since the beginning of the Constitution that if Congress actually has a power granted to it by Congress, then by the Constitution, then state laws, whether traditional or not, must yield by virtue of the supremacy clause to it. So we insisted on the second ground, and the judgment, which was a strategic judgment, was if the court is afraid of the second ground because it might foreclose something it knows not yet what, it could go back to the question of degree, but it was better for us not to do that, but rather to let the court retreat to that, if that is how it chose to save the vitality of Lopez. Let me just speak briefly about the 14th Amendment. The reason that that received less attention was that there are two square holdings of the Supreme Court itself, rather than lower courts, saying that the power under the 14th Amendment is a power only against state actors. It cannot be deployed against non-state individuals. And of course, if you think of the history of the fight for equal rights for women, take the case in which the practice of making it much harder for women to become administrators of the states than men. If the Vawa theory had prevailed, then not only would these practices or the laws that allow them be struck down as they were and properly were, but it would have been the basis for Congress of turning over to the federal courts all administration of all the states. And that, of course, is a result that certainly the court would blanch from. And I think it was fairly easy to show that the slippery slope was here very steep, very slippery, and quite short. Let me just finish with a quote from a very eloquent and important supporter of the Violence Against Women Act, Professor Sally Goldfarb, who wrote that the enactment of VAWA occurred against the backdrop of vigorous opposition by federal and state judges who objected that it would bring private matters into federal court. The passage of the legislation seemed to signal the definitive arrival of violence against women into the public sphere of law and politics. Well, with all respect, that is nonsense. When I decided the custody of Vaughan, I did not imagine I was deciding a private matter, or that when the state courts consider rape or violence cases, they are acting elsewhere than in the public sphere. They are simply not acting in the federal sphere. That is all that was involved. Quite simply, the federal criminal code, the federal civil code, cannot be allowed to be turned into a billboard. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Fried. And now we'll hear from Professor McKinnon.
Hello, everyone. Is this functioning? Is it now working?
It's supposed to be on. Is it on? No. Yes, it's on. It says green. Hello? Now is it working? Okay. Okay. Hello. Thanks for saying hi back, and I'm glad to be here. I think it's fair to observe that the discussion that we've heard so far about the law against violence against women makes it sound like it's about a great many things except violence against women. I am going to address all of those other things, but the way I would like to frame my contribution to this discussion toward our later, further discussion with all of you and together with each other is, first of all, to take the freedom that we have here to be more candid than one could be if one was arguing this, before a court and make what I see to be the affirmative case for the Violence Against Women Act that is at once a legal and political argument. And then secondly, talk in a narrower way about some of the constitutional issues that Charles has raised. The way I see this is part one, what's really going on here, why I'm right. Part two, constitutional law more narrowly framed, why Charles is wrong. Okay? And discussions of strategic issues, the hard issues, et cetera, intermixed within throughout. The case that gave rise to this case is a reasonably typical case of violence against women. Diane has already described it to you briefly, but it involves two young men, varsity football players, alleged to have raped a co-student of theirs three times by force, holding her down, penetrating her vaginally, 30 minutes after meeting her. There were students in a state school. No condoms were used shortly after the acts took place. One of the individuals, Mr. Morrison, stated to Christy Brancala, "You better not have any fucking diseases," and later announced publicly, as Diane mentioned, that he liked to get girls drunk and fuck the shit out of them. There was a fair amount of support, as often there is, around the two young men for these acts. And Mr. Crawford, the other individual who Christy Brancala said raped her, was overheard being told by another person that he, Mr. Crawford, should have killed the bitch, unquote. What also followed after this was fairly typical as well, which I will merely call the institutional jerk around, in which you have hearings, you're told you people believe you, you have more hearings, they do next to nothing about it, there's unending abuses of process, etc. They essentially find that he does it, they essentially do nothing about it. The individual who did these things gets a full scholarship. I mean, continues to get a lot of money and support and whatever. I just present this to you as a reasonably typical, although in this case through a school, but a reasonably typical shape of things. It's also of interest that these facts by a not sympathetic Fourth Circuit were found adequate to meet the gender animus standard of the Violence Against Women Act for purposes at least of a motion to dismiss. Although that court was not entirely sure that those facts would show what it wants to see in the gender-based animus case for summary judgment or for a directed verdict. Now, this is what I want to say to you about the Violence Against Women Act and what I see to be the real argument for it. I think in a real sense that this case is our civil war. Ours, I mean, women's. It's our fight at once over the structure of the union and our place in it, and at the same time over women's status in civil society, whether we are full citizens and full human beings. Prior sex equality statutes, however crucial they have been for us, statutes giving equal rights in private, in employment, in school, in public accommodations, did not, in my view, begin at ground zero of women's status, which is subjection to sex-based violation, including violence, sexual and physical. The Violence Against Women Act does begin at that ground zero, and where it begins is with zero tolerance for gender-based violence. Says, all persons within the United States shall have the right to be free from crimes of violence motivated by gender. This is the first time ever zero tolerance for gender-based violence has ever been a part of public policy. the background of this law is, in fact, no right to be free of violence because someone is a woman or a man. The Violence Against Women Act says that gender-based violence is an equality problem, and I want to say briefly why it is within the ambit of the 14th Amendment, thus bringing it within Section 5's power initially, that is, to effectuate the equal protection of the laws. First of all, violence against women is sex-based because women are subjected to aggression and abuse by men in distinctive forms because we are women. That is, women are harmed by gender-based violence in our status as women. And this includes rape, battering, sexual abuse in childhood, prostitution, pornography. There is a massive amount of data on this. It is all sex differential in nature. Now, Justice Scalia mentioned an oral argument in the Violence Against Women Act, and Professor Glendon of this faculty also argued in an amicus brief in the Violence Against Women Act case, in this case, that all of this data doesn't support the Violence Against Women Act because it isn't all sex-based necessarily, particularly not within the definition that is offered by the Violence Against Women Act itself. What I would say to this is that, first of all, a misreading of the massive body of data that is available on this is being made. But in particular, I would say that all sexual violence and violence against women by men, in my sense, that is, in a real lived sense, is sex-based. However, it isn't all actionable under the Violence Against Women Act because the Violence Against Women Act only permits that part of it that is shown to be due at least in part to an animus based on the victim's gender. What that means is that it is all a subset of this very massive body of sex-based violence, but it is within that very massive data. In other words, there's a huge body of data in front of Congress about a real problem that is based on sex, within which all sex-based animus-inspired violence is included. I would also like to point out a couple of cases that seem not to have been mentioned in the briefs or argued, and that is that cases that actually recognize that violence against women is a form, raises equality problems, is an inequality problem. And one is Dothert against Rawlinson. It's a Title VII case, but it includes a constitutional dimension, and it holds that it states that to be raped is to be violated based on, quote unquote, her very womanhood. In a way that in that case, unfortunately, made it possible not to hire women for specific jobs because they might get raped. But that particular, the legal move there was to say that if you might get raped, that was a sex-based reason that in their view was permissible for why you shouldn't be hired. But my point here is that it's sex-based either way. In other words, being raped, to be raped, is to be a woman in the legal sense. And that is gender-based for legal purposes. On the other, of course, body of law, which is very large, is under sexual harassment, in which sex-based violation has been found to be a form of sex-based discrimination. Now, the Violence Against Women Act would require that this be done case by case, but I'm just pointing out the ways in which sexual violence in particular is sex-based in a way that brings it within the ambit of the concerns that have already been recognized as sex equality concerns. The second point I want to make here is that all of this violence against women, amply documented, takes place against a backdrop of near total official impunity at every level. That is, violence against women is well documented to be unreported by about a factor of 10 for reasons that the justified skepticism that anything will be done about it. And once even those very few that are reported, there is a disproportionate and well-documented fall-off between them being done and then anything ultimately, eventually being done about them, to the point where an act of violence against women about which anything is done is in the single-digit numbers of proportion relative to the amount of violation that actually takes place. Now, to this point, it has come to seem to me that the distinctive structure of state discrimination against women, in this area in particular, is to pass criminal laws against acts that are actually sex-based violence and then do little to nothing with them or about them. This describes the pattern of child abuse, rape, battering, prostitution, including, by which I mean, pimps and tricks. Nothing is done about them. And pornography. Now, this pattern does not have to be conscious or conspiratorial to take place. It is indeed, I think, ideological. A good bit of it is not within the existing legal definition of what is recognized as intentional discrimination under the 14th Amendment. The definition of intent, indeed, under the 14th Amendment has made the 14th Amendment nearly worthless to women. That is, its definition is if you don't think bad thoughts about women while doing bad things to them, it doesn't violate the Equal Protection Clause. In reality, this makes it almost impossible to prove that women are violated in a way that the Equal Protection Clause will recognize. The other key element here, of course, is what Charles has mentioned, the state action requirement. What I'd also just like to observe here is that while that requirement is somewhat flexible, and I'm not acting like it's utterly precluded from bringing actions either for intentional discrimination or forms of state action, most of the acts of violence against women are engaged in by non-state actors, people who are not themselves, that is, absolutely official. However, they are engaged in with virtually total assurance that they will be tolerated officially, that they will be officially invisible, that they will be officially, in essence, silent. That is, they will be kept private. In this way of looking at it, the state, in fact, enforces the private by ignoring what happens there so that the public officials say that a particular act isn't a public act, and that at most is official or state inaction, which is then not regarded enforceably as state action. My point here is that, in a sense, the state is already everywhere. That is, the idea of this public-private line is not operative in reality for women. The man who beats his wife at home is not distinctively different from the cop who beats the prostitute in the lockup. In other words, you have a man beating his wife at home and you have a cop beating a prostitute in a lockup, and one is considered private and the other is considered public. But from the standpoint of women, the distinction between the two of them is not operative. And although one is potentially actionable and under the 14th Amendment and the other is not. Similarly, I would like to suggest that just as the public-private line is not operative in women's situations, rape in Virginia is rape in Massachusetts is rape in California, in a sense that lines from one state to another state to another state are also not particularly operative in the reality of the lives of women either. My basic suggestion here is that violence against women in reality operates in women's lives more like an everyday habit something that is done to us than it does as an effective crime, and basically next to nothing is done about it. And that the Violence Against Women Act aims to intervene in this by holding perpetrators accountable to the people they hurt directly. And in so doing, shift the power that has been held exclusively by the criminal law into the hands of the people who are hurt. Now, why is this acceptable Section 5 legislation? First of all, this is a sex equality issue for the reasons I've just articulated. Constitutionally, I want to argue that we have a choice here. That is, this is not a constitutional arrangement where we are absolutely compelled to come to one conclusion or another. I'm going to give you the best reading I can of where these precedents sit in relation to the Violence Against Women Act. I will divide these into, first, the federalism concerns, and second, the Commerce Clause concerns. The federalism concerns I have in my mind as answering the question, are the states being hurt by this? The Commerce Clause concerns I have in my mind as answering the question, is the economy being hurt by this? You will note that neither the states nor the economy are necessarily women who are the ones who are hurt by violence against women. Now, I would suggest to you that the Violence Against Women Act is constitutional under our federalism precedents, first of all because of the massive findings of inadequacies of state mechanisms that exist in the record. That is, the bias, the discrimination that is shown in those findings is substantively adequate to the standard of providing relief. Now, there's more to that discussion. The second point here is that unlike in the cases that have been described, the Violence Against Women Act directly supplements rather than supplants state remedies. In other words, it respects the states. That's why so many of them are for it, in large part. It builds in state definitions of acts. It permits concurrent jurisdiction, that is to say, bringing claims in state courts. There is no slippery slope here, immediately into everything is federal. People are allowed to go to state courts. Presumably the state courts are as receptive as some people say they are and ready to give relief. State courts can give relief under this. It also does not expand liability for state action or definitions of action or inaction. That is to say, it doesn't allow people to sue the states directly, which, of course, is helpful from a number of standpoints, including 11th Amendment issues. And 36 states plus the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico support this remedy. They see it as federalism friendly. So all the, you know, they basically say the states are not hurt by this. They say, we're drowning, help. You know, we can't really do this alone. This will help us. So it isn't displacing the states. The states are not the victims here. You know, this out-victiming the victim move that is taking place in some of the briefs on the other side. Also specifically what I would say about Florida Prepaid and Bernie is that there are two ways to cut this. One is under them and the other is distinguishing from them. Under them, it's possible to say that the point is that Congress can remedy flaws that result from state processes so long as those inadequacies are documented as pervasive and the federal remedies are connected to the inadequacies that are documented. And that was done here. The other way to go at it, though, is to say that the other thing to notice is, of course, that the Violence Against Women Act does not overturn any Supreme Court rulings. It isn't going in there and saying, well, we're going to fight with the Supreme Court about what we can do here under the scope of Section 5 of the 14th Amendment because we don't like something the Supreme Court did. It's just simply saying the states, the people that the 14th Amendment was designed to address discriminatory behavior of, have been engaging in a broad kind of discrimination that is well documented and within their ambit. And they're going after that without overturning anything that the Supreme Court has previously held. But, okay, that's sort of in between those two categories. But the final thing here is that some of the more expansive readings of some of this line of cases, I think offers an overly narrow reading of the congressional power. And that in particular, building on Katzenbach against Morgan and that line of cases in the equality area, that there is room here for the Violence Against Women Act. And I'd especially suggest that people might want to, as an indication of the strategic possibilities here, look at Justice O'Connor's concurrence in Bray, as well as the concurrence by both O'Connor and Kennedy in Lopez. That's just a strategic reference. And I would add here, and this is too often ignored, that international law expands, makes it possible to expand somewhat the congressional power to legislate in compliance with our international obligations, including treaty obligations and customary international law, which I'm not saying you can overturn something of the Constitution on the basis of international law. That's not this argument. The argument is, given that we already can do this within the existing structure of federalism, recognizing too that this is an equality issue of a specific kind under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, falling outside the Bernie problem, that at that point we get additional support from international law to legislate here. Now I want to talk just for a moment about whether the economy is hurt by this. The test here is, well, the requirement is that we need a rational basis for concluding that the regulated activity substantially burdens, affects interstate commerce. There really is massive evidence here that a half of the population cannot productively live and work, spend and travel when they are being beaten, being violated, being targeted for violation, being threatened. When that happens, they are hurt, and in the process, the economy is hurt. Now, whether this is quote-unquote economic in nature is actually interestingly answered by my colleagues at the University of Chicago, who actually see many things as economic in nature. I would suggest to you that the economy is not defined in nature. And actually, just to be very brief, that this is in fact more economic in its impact than gun-free school zones. To conclude, we have society structured along male-dominant lines such that violence against women happens and happens pervasively. We have states that make some of it facially criminal, but in reality do little to nothing about it. We then have courts interpreting the Constitution to largely preclude the ability of women to do anything about the states doing relatively nothing about violence against women that continues to be done in society. Now, we are being told, including by Charles, that the Constitution means that we can't do anything about it when Congress has decided to give us a tool to do it. In other words, we have to go back to the states who do discriminate on the basis of sex in exactly this way and admit to doing it, and try to extract relief from those who have committed this discrimination against us, or get nothing. In other words, go work it out at home. As if we already have equal civil rights, as if we are, if we were civil equals, if we were legal equals, being told to go work it out at home might make some sense. The Violence Against Women Act is at once an act of despair and of hope. Despair with existing remedies and hope for better ones. Hope building on the 19th Amendment's recognition that women are federal citizens, building on existing sex equality precedents created by the courts, clear of prohibitions that would undo the federal system, hope that women can be full public citizens in this federal nation, and full human beings in this civil society in our lifetimes. Thanks.
Like some people are leaving, so we'll give them a minute to get out. And now we can turn this over. Thank you very much, Professor McKinnon.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you, Professor Fried. We will now turn it over to Professor Balkin in the back of the room and find out what's been going on in the online discussion.
Thank you very much, Diane. We have over 250 people online here from law schools, law firms, places around the country, and people around the world, people from as far away as Taiwan. There has been a lively discussion in a number of the chat rooms. People have been talking about... I'll try and speak up, Charles. They've been talking about a number of issues involving... Well, they want to ask you in particular a number of things, and they want to ask Professor McKinnon a number of things. Diane, how should we arrange this? I have about five or so questions, some of which could be answered by both of them, some by one or the other.
Let's start with two questions and then move it to the live audience, and then we'll go back. So we'll take two and then three from the live audience, and then we'll go back to you.
I would say, Professor Fried, that one question that came up over and over again was why you need to say a little bit more about the 14th Amendment argument. It was the argument that Professor McKinnon was pushing in her remarks, and it was one that many people in the chat rooms thought was probably the stronger basis for the statute. There are many versions of the argument. A very simple one would simply be this, that the 14th Amendment has a lot of clauses in it, and one of the clauses is the citizenship clause. That says that that everybody born in the United States or naturalized thereof is a citizen of the United States and of the state in which they reside. And you could argue that the civil rights cases were wrong about the idea that the Congress doesn't have a power to enforce that. And you could argue along the lines of Harlan's dissent that, in fact, Congress has independent power to protect citizenship rights and equal citizenship rights in particular, and that you could see VAWA not unremarkably as being about equal citizenship. So that's one example of a kind of 14th Amendment argument that could have been raised. And I should point out for those of you in the audience that the Supreme Court didn't get much time to talk about the 14th Amendment in the actual oral argument. There really wasn't much time for it, but it certainly is one of the possible grounds. So one thing that might be useful is to talk a little bit about the 14th Amendment and how it applied to this case.
Well, I think the reason that none of the litigants, by the time the case got to the Supreme Court, gave as much emphasis to the 14th Amendment as they did to the Commerce Clause, was that the precedents in the Supreme Court, going back a long time, really had quite a preclusive effect. And without getting too detailed and technical, I think the most dramatic way to see that is to speak not about gender violence, but about race and race violence. Because surely all of the things that Catherine spoke about could be said and could rightly be said about the history of race in this country. And indeed, the 14th Amendment was passed specifically with race in mind. And yet, repeatedly, it has been held by the courts and has been understood as the doctrine that the 14th Amendment does not create causes of action to individuals who have been harmed by virtue of race rather than state action. And as I say, everything that Professor McKinnon has said about gender might be said with equal force about race. It's very striking that when the Civil Rights Acts were passed in 1964, the ones to which Professor McKinnon referred, Dofford and Rawlinson and sexual harassment and so on, those acts were not predicated on the 14th Amendment because they were not directed at action by state actors. It was quite clear that those acts relied on the Commerce Clause because in every instance they dealt with economic transactions, employment, transportation, public accommodations, and the like, so that the whole history of the 14th Amendment, the understanding of it, is, as I have suggested, and the race example strongly bears that out. Now, what you mentioned, Jack, is certainly a possible view of the 14th Amendment. It may even be a better view, but it is not a view that the majorities of the Supreme Court for the last 140 years have been taken, and therefore it did not seem, I suppose, to anyone a particularly promising line of support.
Sure. I think that what you raised is a good and promising line of support. I do also want to just point out that in law, everything is done for the first time sometime. And that isn't to make the claim that this case is, you know, utterly unlike anything else or a million, 1,000% unprecedented or whatever, but there, and it isn't to abandon any of the precedential support that I already laid out here for the possibility of doing this. But this is the first time that these facts have been posed to this court or to any prior court. And I think the urgency of them is in favor of finding that this is a constitutional remedy. All the other words used by Charles to characterize the Violence Against Women Act as popular, attractive, and things like that are usually taken as virtues. I would be glad if it was an attractive and popular thing. But Dofford actually was brought against state actors, although the part that I was talking about was essentially predicated on Title VII. And there was some not terribly clear discussion, but nonetheless discussion that the result would have been the same if it had been predicated under the Constitution, and part of it is actually predicated under the Constitution. And I don't think we're really here to argue for constitutional purposes that violence against women is not sex-based, are we?
No.
Okay.
It's just not... It's not state action.
Okay.
So I don't quarrel
okay.
with that.
In Dofford, actually, it was state action, but it, so long
state
as...
state action, there's no problem.
Right.
Not for me, not for you, not for the court.
Okay, good. So what I would like to say to that is that acts do not go around with labels on them that say private. This is private. The line between public and private is a line that is drawn in law over time. That, you know, when you first say, bring up, addressing the employment sphere, say, you know, under labor law, you have a big fight about whether that's going to be something that can be regulated or not, and we're told it's private. You bring up addressing it under employment law, and we're told it's private. It's the private marketplace. Now, employment is considered the public and able to be addressed to the extent it is addressed, say, under Title VII as public. What you have here is a vast involvement of the state apparatus. I mean, it's really hard to argue on the one hand that the state has nothing to do with violence against women, and on the other, everything it's already done or that's already there is perfectly legally adequate to address any problems that exist. I mean, but in any event, the state is deeply involved in violence against women on every level of its existence, all the way from defining certain things as crossing certain lines to doing nothing about, you know, acts across the board. And what this is saying, you know, what the Arguments for Violence Against Women Act is saying is that for 14th Amendment purposes, I put it this way. There's a difference between acts that you could successfully sue a state for and acts that, when fully documented, make out a adequate basis for legislating by Congress under the 14th Amendment. In other words, over here are what is under the 14th Amendment and you could successfully sue a state for. Over here, included in that, including those things, but much more broadly, are acts that you may not, in fact, be able to successfully sue a state for, but that are in the realm of the public and that can provide a basis for legislation that addresses the problem of the state doing nothing about those acts. In other words, some people get equal protection of the laws. They are more likely to be men. Other people do not. In this area, they are women. Congress can legislate that equality problem, that problem of not getting equal protection of existing laws, beyond what we could make the Supreme Court make the states do about it. So that's, as I see it, the structure of the 14th Amendment.
I think it's important to just focus for a moment on what the actual cause of action here is. It is a federal court action for what, under the laws of every state I know of, constitutes a battery. There may be one or two anomalous state rules having to do with intermarital and domestic violence, which would prevent a battery, but generally in every state, it's a battery. So it's a question of a federal court battery. Now, it's wonderful that the victims can choose to bring an action. Of course, they can choose to bring an action now in state court. Ah, but state courts are less hospitable. Wait a moment. These are civil causes of action brought by a private plaintiff against a private defendant in state court or in federal court before a jury. So it's the juries which perhaps are unsympathetic, but it's going to be the same jury because the Constitution guarantees you a local jury whether you're suing in state or in federal court. So it's a little hard to see what's added except you get to go into this federal courthouse to face that jury rather than the state courthouse to face
what will eventually be the same jury.
I was going to say that because time is short and there are questions from this audience,
please.
I wanted to say that the other, there were, by the way, after you folks began answering the questions, the discussion really started to heat up in the chat rooms, and there are more questions than we could possibly give you.
Right.
But most of the questions that were directed at you were on a similar set of themes. Not surprisingly, they were not about the 14th Amendment, they were about the Commerce Clause. And they were suggesting that the relation between commerce and what VAWA was protecting against was rather shaky. One person also asked, well, if international law said no guns around schools, would that give Congress the power to pass the law struck down in Lopez? Another asked, if pot affected productivity, would that give Congress the power to reach homegrown pot? And then finally, one person wanted a very specific answer from you on the question of how would Congress be kept from taking over all state criminal laws if VAWA was constitutional under the Commerce Clause. So those were examples of the kinds of questions we were getting.
What I would say is that I think the Commerce Clause argument is in fact strong and clear, but that the limit that people are looking for under the Commerce Clause is provided by Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. That is, one doesn't have an equality right to smoke pot. The all state criminal laws about all things, unless and until there are findings that are as strong going to inequality as the findings before Congress here went to inequality, don't give rise they don't invoke the 14th Amendment in the way it does here. So I would say that, the vast slippery slope, the going from this to everything move, and people are looking for a limiting principle, I would just say that the 14th Amendment is, equality concerns are that limiting principle. And I just add to this that what Charles suggested a few minutes ago about basically to the point this is useless, you're just, going from sort of one state court jury to another state court jury and so on. That I thought was up to Congress. That's a political assessment. They decided that they thought it would be useful. We can talk about the extent to which it would be useful or useless, but it the argument that it's useless is not an argument for its unconstitutionality. Mm-hmm. Aside from the fact that I think it's false.
Okay. If you really want to say something, you can.
Well, it's not quite up to Congress because the court has said it's important that the remedy be congruent.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's not absolutely up to Congress.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now we'll take some questions from the audience, and we have some in the middle. So the first row.
Oh, thank you, Professor McKinnon. I wonder if you could give some examples of ways in which current state civil remedies available to women who have experienced violence are inadequate in comparison with the remedy offered by the Violence Against Women Act. What are the gaps? What are the problems?
Right. The first thing to think about is perhaps a comparison with the Violence Against Women Act and Sexual Harassment Act. It's possible to observe that most of the acts that are actionable under sexual harassment law for federal purposes under Title VII and also state laws that have come in to provide additional remedies for sexual harassment can be construed as battery, intentional infliction of emotional distress, an entire range of existing state torts. So if you want to deconstruct sexual harassment law into a set of constitutive acts, those too might potentially be able to be addressed under state tort law. Fact, they haven't been. Fact, they never were. Fact, they still aren't being. Now, so what's the difference? The difference is somewhat like the difference here. One, however, point that really needs to be made here is that the Violence Against Women Act contains a reference within it to existing state and federal laws of crimes, so that it's already limited by existing state and federal law in a way that I actually oppose. But it's there. So those aren't the civil claims that you asked me about, but just so far as the building in of state law into this federal remedy, it's already, again, in a way that I disagree with, but is there, built in to the Violence Against Women Act. Now, civil. The first thing about the Violence Against Women Act that's different from existing state civil remedies is that it targets acts that it defines as acts of discrimination. In other words, that they're based on sex. Now, that may be seen to be one more thing you have to prove, but as it happens, that's also one of the big differences between sexual harassment law, in which there are, you know, now 10, you know, scores of hundreds of thousands of cases brought by people who are beating down the doors of jurisdictions all up and down to prove sex-based acts against them as an additional requirement. So it must be that there's something about calling the acts what they are that not only mobilizes people to come forward, but makes it more possible to show that they've been hurt in this way. The other things that I would just, a couple of other things I would just note is that particularly with intentional infliction of emotional distress and so on, actually there's an amicus brief filed in this case. You might all want to look at it. It has a very interesting table at the back. I believe it's the brief by Alabama and Texas, the two states that filed against the law, as opposed to the 36 states that filed for it. In there, they have a table at the back showing how, documenting what inextensively what Professor Fried referred to as, you know, here are all these states, here are all these state torts, here is what's available, and so on. It seems to me someone ought to answer the question, if all those things are there and if these things are adequately addressing these problems, why is the data the way it is? Why aren't people bringing these cases? Are women just incapable of seeing their own interests? Are lawyers incapable of being so smart enough to use the law the way all these states are making it available to them? Or is it that there is some real shortfall here? And, you know, the shortfall here includes that it doesn't name the problem what it is, namely based on sex. It includes things like with intentional infliction of emotional distress, particularly, but also in battering claims. Civil, and also civil rape, which some states have. You basically have to show that you are hurt as an individual in a way that has been extremely inhospitable to women showing that they were. Intentional infliction of emotional distress is also very, very hard to prove. It varies by state. So I would say that the biggest difference is that it doesn't call the injury what it is.
Thanks. I think we'll go, it's 9:00 now, we'll take questions from both audiences for the next 15 minutes and we'll adjourn at 9:15. So Jamie, will you take another question? That's fine.
Professor Fried, you seem to suggest that the biggest stumbling block on the Section 5 argument is the existing Supreme Court law just can't be done. And I assume you're really strongly relying on the civil rights cases decision.
And the Harris case, both of which were reaffirmed as recently as Florida prepaid, which was just last year.
Does it bother you to hang your hat on a case, the civil rights case in particular, which when you read it has such a narrow view of Congress's power to address race discrimination, a lot of which, in fact, you know, has really been abrogated in multiple contexts, to say that that really should govern, you know, how we can view Congress's authority to address equality problems today.
It hasn't been abrogated. I mean, if you're saying that the case has been overruled, it has not. I mean, it's the most striking proof of that is that when Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, it did so under the Commerce Clause. It did not use the 14th Amendment. So it hasn't been abrogated.
But it is true that Congress does have some power to address private acts of discrimination in the race context,
indeed,
Section 1981, etc.
In 1985-3, although that's in part under the 13th Amendment.
Well, there's the 13th Amendment,
which we're not 100% wrong.
13th Amendment deals specifically with the slaves and their descendants.
Mm.
So I think that that's just the law. I don't think I'm making it up. I don't know about hanging my hat, but I'm hanging my hat on the law.
Okay. Thanks. There's a question in back. Wait, she'll bring you the microphone.
A question for Professor Fried. You mentioned the spending power for general welfare of Congress. I wonder if this gets, VAWA gets struck down, then why isn't the easy solution for Congress to pass a law saying if states do not enforce their domestic violence laws and other laws similar to VAWA, then Congress will cut all Medicaid funding for states? And under South Dakota v. Dole, why would that not be permissible? And if it is permissible, then why, in fact, would that not be an even greater imposition on the right of states to regulate as they wish?
Well, two things. First, I very much doubt that it could, to make the case even more extreme, I doubt that failure to enforce their existing laws of battery, etc., could be made a reason for withdrawing, let us say, highway funds. I think the court has made it quite clear that there's got to be some nexus. But more positively, the point is that Congress did use the spending power and used it constructively, and I suspect in a way that will have vastly more effects than what we're talking about today. And that is, it is spending money, $1.6 billion, which I grant you is a very small amount of money, I gather, in supporting battered women's shelters and educational programs for the very law enforcement officers who need to understand these areas better. It's quite striking that Catherine refers to these gender bias studies. Well, the states engaged in those gender bias studies in order to improve their own acts. They didn't engage in those studies as a way of building a record for this statute. They did it because they themselves wanted to do something. Interestingly enough, a number of the federal circuits also had gender bias studies and found exactly the same things in the federal courts that the gender bias studies found in the state courts. And those gender bias studies are the basis of improvements within the state. So there are tremendous things that can be done, are being done, and have been done under the rubric of the spending power, which is completely beyond any constitutional doubt.
Okay, thanks. Okay, we'll take one more question from the live audience, and then we'll shift back to Jack and the online audience.
This question is directed at Professor Fried. Professor McKinnon started with what I thought was an interesting allusion, an allusion to VAWA as our civil war, referring to women. And it struck me that, you know, just thinking back to American history class in high school, that Lincoln put aside habeas corpus and there was the prize case.
You've got to speak up, please.
Lincoln put aside habeas corpus in the real Civil War. At least it was arguable, and Chief Justice Taney thought he had. I'm wondering, is there any level of evidence that Professor McKinnon or her side could put forward that you might be tempted to say, this is like a civil war, this is a war, this is an emergency, almost like Chief Justice Rehnquist's recent book about national security, putting aside parts of the textual constitution?
Well, the history, the war idea is very interesting, and of course the analogy to race is very interesting, because you will recall, you seem to be interested in history, that Congress first sought to deal with the problems of race prior to passing the 14th Amendment. And that turned out to require a constitutional amendment. So, in fact, if this is a war, and if, in fact, structural constitutional changes are needed, then the way we get those and hand drop them is through constitutional amendment. And don't tell me it can't be done, because the 13th, the 14th, the 15th, and the 19th Amendment did it.
And the Equal Rights Amendment was not ratified by the majority of the state legislatures.
Okay, we'll move back to the online discussion. A little louder.
Loud.
Yes, I understand. Loud. We have a number of questions bubbling up in cyberspace for you. One question I think several people have asked repeatedly, and it's, I suspect it's directed mostly to Professor Fried, is they're worried about what a decision striking down FOIA would mean for the constitutionality of other civil rights statutes. As you probably know, there are a bunch of challenges to civil rights statutes bubbling up now in the circuit courts, some of them based on the sort of 11th Amendment, 10th Amendment doctrines that the court's been developing. And so that's one set of challenges, and then there, with respect to how they affect state actors. And then there's a concern that there might be other challenges to existing civil rights statutes on the basis of whatever rationale would strike down VAWA. So that's one thing a lot of people were worried about. Another set of questions that people wanted to know was what your sense of the wisdom of Luttig's views about the relationship between violence and women's productivity was. How would you characterize his views? Did you agree with them, or do you think they were over the mark? That was another set of questions that were being discussed. So one was about the future of civil rights laws, if VAWA was struck down, and the second is really about the connection between violence against women and their productivity.
Well, on the future of the civil rights laws, I would have thought that they are no more insecure than they have been since they were since they passed constitutional muster after they were enacted. I don't understand why they would be insecure, because if you're talking about public accommodations, that's plainly directed at either the channels or of commerce or at economic transactions. If you're talking about employment discrimination, there's obviously no problem, because the employment context is an economic transaction. So I don't I don't think the sky is not falling, no. Chicken Little is once again wrong.
If they're not passed under the 14th Amendment, as you well know, then states will be free to violate them, at least with respect to money damages, although, of course, you can get an injunction against them. I think that was part of the question. And that would apply, for example, to disability and discrimination on the basis of homosexuality and discrimination on the basis of age, things that...
It's very striking, and it was, my goodness, it was striking sitting up there at the time of the argument. The moment before the argument began, the Supreme Court decided, handed down the decision in the Kimmel case, which specifically said that the immunity, the 11th Amendment immunity, applied to a action under the Age Discrimination Act. So I don't think there's anything that striking Vollwer down would do that has not already happened.
What about
Title VI? A little sex equality here. I think I'm getting too much attention.
Well, no, but what about Title VI and Title IX?
What about Title VI? Those are spending clause cases that if you don't take the money, you are not subject to the restrictions. And of course, everybody wants the money, and everybody's subject to the restrictions.
Jack, do you have one more question?
Or we can move to the online.
Okay. Where's Jamie with the microphone?
Back there in the blue shirt? Up here? Did you have your hand up? Oh, I'm sorry. You kind of...
Hello. The hypothetical came to mind, which I'm not sure how it quite fits in. If, for example, a bisexual man flipped a coin and decided to have sex with a young boy as opposed to a young girl, how would that fit in under gender-based animus discrimination? And isn't rape rape?
Well, to begin with, someone having sex with someone else is not by itself a violation of the Violence Against Women Act. You said someone had sex with someone else. There's a fair amount of authority building under, you know, already existing laws that make it possible to make sex-specific arguments in same-sex cases that show that if someone selects somebody else on the basis of their sex, even if their sex is the same as the sex of the perpetrator, that the selection of the victim is based on sex. So you still would simply have to show that, and on whatever basis you show it, whether that person be of the same sex or the perpetrator or of any other gender, it could potentially come within the Violence Against Women Act.
But my hypothetical is a self-proclaimed bisexual man that flipped a coin. How would that fit in? And the point is rape rape? Or is
well, you're saying that the way he made that choice is apparently not a form of discrimination on his part on the basis of gender, and I would suggest to you that that is not how people select who they're going to violate.
Question in front, please.
One quick comment and then a question. My comment is that I'm concerned about the extent to which Professor Fried dismisses the notion of state action in a 14th Amendment, under the 14th Amendment, because it seems to me, however you see the data, there's at least an inextricable intertwining of the role of the state and the private action. And I think in light of how striking the numbers are, it's clearly better where there's an intertwining to err in favor of protecting the 14th Amendment's interests. That's just my comment. And I think you can't draw hard lines, but until you can draw better lines, you know, the federal government does have a responsibility, a clear historical responsibility to get involved. My question is to, again, Professor Fried, under the Commerce Clause, whether you would see any constitutional problems if the statute specifically required on a case-by-case basis that the woman demonstrate that she had an economic difficulty associated with the violence. For example, she couldn't work for a year or two or couldn't get a job because she was a victim of battering in her home and so on. And then if so, you know, at what point would you be satisfied that maybe on a case-by-case basis, you know, it just isn't necessary anymore? Because I think that's really what's underneath the data, is these real-world cases. So my first question is, if it were a requirement under the statute, would you see a constitutional problem under the Commerce Clause And then secondly, what you would do about it in a broader sense to make things easier.
Well, the criminal statute, the criminal prosecution statute, does have what the constitutional lawyers refer to as a jurisdictional hook, in the sense that it is necessary to show, in this case, the crossing of a state line. Mm-hmm. And you're proposing that in the civil context, there also might be an amendment which would create a jurisdictional hook in the form of some interstate or some commercial showing. I think that would make an enormous difference, yes. Whether it would make all the difference, one would need to know, you know, sort of what the hook was, and I'm loath to draft it sort of here on the floor with you, but I can imagine jurisdictional hooks which would work. In the criminal area, there have been cases brought, and the Supreme Court has regularly denied certiorari on them because they're so clearly valid.
In the case, in the Brancala case, there was evidence of economic harm to her since she had to withdraw from school and then mm-hmm. was unable to finish school to date and is suffering economic injury.
Mm-hmm. But it's not part of the cause of action. And that's your point. If it were made part of the cause of action.
But it is in her fact. Yeah.
It's a question back there.
I wonder, you said that there is a lot of rhetorical value in calling an injury, in identifying this injury, that the huge way in which women are violated is through violence that's motivated by gender animosity. But I wonder if having a value in that rhetoric robs us of any chance of calling all rape violence against women, that rape is essentially violence that is based on gender animus, and that to sort of draw this distinction that Congress has drawn might ultimately result in a problematic paradigm in which we begin to identify some violence against women as non-gender animated and some violence against women as gender animated.
Yeah, I wasn't meaning to say that the value of calling this what it is rhetorical. I was meaning to say that the value of calling violence against women what it is, which is to say sex-based, is both principled and practical. Principled for the reasons I argued, but practical because you see women coming forward to make these claims once you call it what it really is. But your real question about is there a problem here? In having gender-based animus defining more narrowly a category of all rape as the actionable kind of rape, I would not have done what they did. I would not have made there be any mental requirement here. I wouldn't have had the perpetrator have it be proved that the perpetrator had an intent, a purpose, a motive, an animus, a head of any kind when doing what he did with his body to her. Among the reasons I wouldn't have done that are the one you raised. This was actually put in because the federal judges required it. In a compromise, in a lobbying situation. That is, they required some mental element. I think, yes, there is a danger that this subset might ultimately not even be found to be as big a subset of the whole violence against women that it should be. So I think there's the danger that you say, and there's even a larger one, I guess, if animus is interpreted extremely narrowly here. I still think that, I mean, first of all, that's obviously not a reason to strike this down. It is a reason to be concerned that it may not go far enough.
Okay, now we'll turn back to Jack.
We have two last questions, one for Professor Fried and one for Professor McKinnon. The question for Professor Fried is to ask you is to follow up on the question that was asked before. They wanted you to say a little bit about your view on the relationship between violence against women and lost productivity for women, and whether that could be the predicate for a Commerce Clause power to pass the statute. They were particularly upset at what Luddick had to say about that question. They want to know what your views were. And the issue for Professor McKinnon that was asked was, can you identify any federal statute that would not fall either under the Commerce Power or under the 14th Amendment enforcement power as you understand them?
So I'm going to ask that we keep our answers to these questions brief because the hour is getting late and we've gone over time a little bit. I really appreciate the indulgence of everyone in the audience and the online audience. I know it's late. You've all had hard days and appreciate your attention. So,
Very quickly then, I would say that Luddick was approximately right because the economic entailments of violence against women are similar to and really indistinguishable from the economic entailments of violence of all sorts, that violence in neighborhoods, violence against the elderly, violence against any vulnerable population, or indeed a general climate of violence, is exactly the kind of thing that depresses economic activity. And that was, of course, the point of the dissenters in the Lopez case, and it wasn't enough.
What I'd say to the question, you know, are there any federal statutes that are not under my view of either the Commerce Clause or Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, is most of them. That is, most statutes don't have a showing of a specific massive impact on productivity of half the country.
The question was, could you just identify one statute that would be unconstitutional if passed by Congress? That was the only question.
Pardon?
The question just was, name one statute that would actually be unconstitutional if it were passed by Congress. And it, because it was not within the power of Congress to pass under Commerce or 14th Amendment.
I think that I'd rather confine myself here rather than to thinking about unconstitutional things that Congress could do under my view of a correct principle, to talk about what is correct about what Congress has done here under my view of a correct principle. Realities that don't meet the standard that this does of inequality on the basis of sex would not be constitutional under my view of the reach of what Section 5 of the 14th Amendment authorizes. Anything that doesn't meet that standard. Any law isn't under that. It may be under something else, you know, many other parts of the Constitution that would authorize it, just not under this. I mean, if you don't make the case for inequality, you don't have a Section 5 possibility.
It's kind of a hard question to answer in the negative. But in closing, this has been a really provocative discussion on an issue that's so real and so hard to grapple with, because it's not like race-based discrimination and it's not exactly like hate crimes, but it's out there. And when I was with the Department of Justice, I heard stories from all over the country about the extent and the type of violence and the deprivations that were going on across the country, and it really is could give rise to a civil war. I'd have to agree with you. It's really a problem. It's different from race discrimination because it's done against women and we're not a visible minority. We're a majority or an equal
component of the population, and it's not exactly like hate, because in race-based hate, you can hate another race and then just exclude them from your life in a way that you cannot do with women, because you still have to deal with women in your life, so instead you deal with them, but it's often in a discriminatory and dominance-based way. So the question of how we address this and what the appropriate role of our government is in helping women achieve full equality is the most important question around, I'd say. And I hear a little baby that's agreeing with me. So on that note, I want to...
He's saying I'm
it's
hungry.
All in perception. I just want Rebecca to tell us how we can access the online discussion from this and what is going to follow from this in the cyber world. And then we'll close. And again, I appreciate all your attention. Oh, very much. Sorry. Thank you all very much for coming, and to everybody online also for coming and participating so actively. I'd like to invite you all back to our website for more discussion about this, and I hope that this has provoked a lot more questions for everyone to discuss. I know it has so far in the online audience. When the decision is issued by the Supreme Court, we'll have this decision online and commentary from the participants about the decision. We'll also have the full archive of the video and the webcast of this, as well as the archive of the discussions that took place online during the event. So thank you all very much for coming.
Okay.
And just finally, any predictions?
I support.
That's a good prediction.
I actually think I close to agree with that, but I think we're going to win.
Thank you very much.